Good morning. Was that an original composition? Wow. I heard people trying to hold back on those tickly coughs that a lot of us have. Mine is returned after being almost gone, so I may be breaking for a cough every now and then. But don't worry, because I hear a bunch of you still doing it too. We're all together in this one. But you wanted to hold your breath so you could hear every breath of that song. Well, there's really no list ranking the characters in the Old Testament from the best to the worst. But if there was, I'd guess that King David would show up somewhere near both ends of it. Here you see him doing heroic stuff like braining that giant Goliath with a sling stone. But look over there and you'll find him doing things that are awfully naughty. For example, one day when he was out on his palace roof, he peeped into a neighbor's house and saw a beautiful woman bathing. Now, very few of us would look away without a single glance at a naked stranger. Should I call for a show of hands of who would look away? But even fewer of us would go ahead and do something like what David did next. He inquired around and learned that the woman's name was Bathsheba and that she was the wife of one of his best soldiers, Uriah the Hittite. David had her brought to his house, then his bed, and soon she sent word that he was pregnant. David then arranged for Uriah to be sent to the front lines in the next battle without any backup, and he was killed. Next, David sent for Bathsheba. This is the Bible now, and brought her into his house. She became his wife and bore him a son. But what David had done was wrong in the eyes of the Lord. Wrong in anybody else's eyes? I mean, you don't have to be a religious conservative to agree with the Lord on this one, right? David, you see, was already married and had many wives, many children, and more than enough of everything and everyone that he needed. So, here we read, the Lord sent Nathan the prophet to David, who said to the king, there were once two men in the same city, one rich, the other poor. The rich man had large flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing of his own except one little ewe lamb. You might recognize this reading from my last sermon. It'll also be in my next sermon. It's a series. He reared it himself, this little ewe lamb, and it grew up in his home with his own sons. It ate from his dish, drank from his cup, and nestled in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. One day a traveler came to the rich man's house, and he, too mean to take something from his own flocks and herds to give to his guest, stole the poor man's lamb and served it up for dinner. David was very angry and burst out, as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He shall pay for the lamb four times over because he's done this and shown no pity. Then Nathan said to David, you are the man. This is the word of the Lord. I anointed you king over Israel. I gave you everything I needed. I gave you the daughters of Israel and Judah. And had this not been enough, I would have added other favors as great. But you have murdered Uriah and have stolen his wife. You have done wrong in the eyes of the Lord. Well, the great liberal Christian preacher, Fred Craddock, who teaches at Emory University, tells this story as an example of what he calls overhearing. And he uses it to teach his seminary students what he believes is the best way to preach. Let your listeners overhear their own story in whatever story you might choose to tell from the pulpit. Like King David did when he heard the story of the rich man and the poor little lamb. Let them judge their own actions based on what they hear. Again, like David did. And now, let's sing like we wanted to be overheard by the people next door, over at the Eagles or over at the used car lot. Hymn number 6, Just As Long As I Have Breath. Number 6. Thank you. If people ever look back in years to come and say, well, what did the Unitarian Universalist movement do best? I think that our hymns are such a nice way to sing songs that are spiritually and religiously uplifting without hitting you over the head with any particular theology. And that was a pretty good example. Well, today I want to tell you the story of someone who may be the worst so-called Unitarian Universalist. And see those air quotes. The worst Unitarian Universalist that I ever met. I don't want to tell you her real name, so I've chosen instead to call her Dorsine. I don't think that's anybody's name. At least it isn't hers. It's common when a minister and a congregation are forming a new relationship for a day to come that seems like election day, when the congregation votes whether to go forward with that relationship or not. Before the vote on continuing my ministry came up before Dorsine's congregation, she approached me to say that she thought that a minister should wear a suit and tie. I told her that I thought that the suit and tie were suited for businessmen and politicians, and also for Malaya, who you might have seen earlier. She makes that thing look good, right? But that I was not in business or politics, nor was I Malaya. I didn't know her yet. She repeated that she liked to see a man in a suit and tie and wouldn't vote for one who didn't wear them. I didn't think she was kidding, but she did laugh when I promised that I would wear a suit and tie if I ever performed a memorial service for her. There was only one vote against calling me to that historically universalist church. Dorsine came up to me later and proudly announced that the vote was her. I told her that I knew it was, and that was okay. If she really felt so strongly about the tie, it was important for her to do what she thought was right. I wish that I could tell you that I stood up to her every time and did what was right in my own eyes on much more important matters than the tie, the way the prophet Nathan stood up to King David. I wish I could tell you that, but I can't. I first met Dorsine a week before the vote at a dinner planned to introduce me to the oldest and most powerful families, not only in the church, but in the whole surrounding area. Let's say that it was a big, isolated rutabaga-growing valley in the northeast, although it wasn't. Let's also say that most agricultural workers and the majority of the laboring class in the area were poor, French-speaking Haitians. Although they weren't. This is close enough to the real physical and social geography of what really happened for purposes of overhearing. The church had the names of the powerful, English-speaking, rutabaga field-owning families who were my hosts that night on its beautiful stained glass windows. So you might think they owned the place. The purpose of the dinner was to let me know that more or less, they did. Okay. We've got an electronic problem here.
We're overhearing.
You're overhearing. Are we good? Okay. You're fast, Vicky. That was just really quick. Okay, so The church had the names of those families up there to let us know that they more or less owned the place, and the purpose of the dinner was to tell me that, yes, they pretty much did, right? Later, I learned that these families were actually closely intermarried so that things would stay that way. I'd stumble onto a sort of a feudal system right in the USA. But the strangest thing was that so many of the feudal lords of the valley were UUs. See the air quotes? Dinner was prepared by French-speaking servants and punctuated by Dorsine and some of the other local lords and ladies with cracks about the Haitians and their backward Catholic faith, right in front of the Haitian maid who was pouring wine and water for her masters. I was making up my mind that I didn't much like Dorsine, but that I could try to avoid having problems with her. I was also holding my tongue about her insensitivity to Constance, the maid whom she called Connie, with or without her leave, I don't know. I still regret that. I was acting like there was an election coming the next week, or a possible job offer, not a call to speak the truth and serve it as best I could. I ate the food at a feast served up by the rich at the expense of the poor, like the poor man's pet lamb served up in the Bible story. I heard Dorsine speak on several occasions about how well the landowning families treated their Haitians, but I also had several chances to see how poorly she thought of them. The church rented its facilities to a fast-growing Haitian congregation of Seventh-day Adventists on Saturdays. When Dorsine's grandson was planning to get married, she showed up unannounced at the counseling session that I'd scheduled for the young couple. The first item on her agenda was to try to convince me that grandson Clint, who never attended the church and lived and worked out of the valley, should be exempt from building use fees and the usual fee for my services, since he'd gone there as a child and was her grandson, and have a look up at the family name on the window just behind the pulpit, Reverend. Grandma was also planning the wedding. I mean, the couple were planning the wedding. On a Saturday early, to be followed by a brunch reception on Dorsine's rutabaga plantation. Couldn't I do something about getting the SDAs, the Seventh-day Adventists, out of there that day? I told her that's not my decision to make. It would probably violate our legal agreement with them. It seemed wrong to displace an entire congregation to accommodate one family, and she could petition the board if she wanted to. Board support for the SDAs using the church was an old issue for Dorsine. She told me, "I never thought they should be here." And then she wondered aloud what these Haitians were doing worshiping in a Protestant church on Saturday, since weren't they all supposed to be Catholics anyway, worshiping the Pope? I noticed the grandson's fiancé looking to me for help several times during this harangue, looking sheepish, you could say, like a little lamb who fears that instead of being at the center, seated at the center, she might be laid out on the top of her own wedding table next to the roasted rutabagas with a plum in her mouth and mint sauce on the side. I was sorry that I was in no position to help her then, but hoped that I could do so at our next counseling session without Grandma there. Between these two sessions, Dorsine called to tell me to be sure to ask the couple about plans to raise their kids Catholic or UU. I hadn't had a chance to find out the first time that the young woman herself was Catholic, let alone had a chance to talk through the possibility of letting her faith tradition be some part of her children's future. Grandma assured me on this one, "Clint will call the wedding off if she won't give in." Now that's the UU spirit. If they're still married, I'll eat my tie. I regret to say that I did perform the wedding against all my better instincts. It was a surprisingly warm day late in the fall, and I sweated profusely throughout the service. Drops of it were running off my nose and staining the pages on my ceremony script. I'm not sure if it was just the heat or if it was the bad faith steaming underneath my robe and stole, but I made a vow that this would not happen again. Within a year, Dorsine contacted me about performing a service for her daughter, who was remarrying after a divorce. "Sorry," I said, "telling the truth, I'll be out of town at that time at a conference." She offered to have a private plane pick me up mid-conference, fly me back to the church for the wedding, then take me back to the conference, and even to pay me something for my services this time. I refused as politely as I could. But I don't mean to suggest that Dorsine never made an unselfish effort to be kind. When she learned that my wife and I have birthdays just 2 days apart, she offered to bake us a cake and bring it to the Sunday service. "No candles to blow out, though," she added, "because I'm worried about AIDS." Pam pointed out later, I was a little slow, that This must mean that Dorsine was worried about us having AIDS. We'd been living in a big city before our move to the little rutabaga capital of America, the kind of place where AIDS was. We know it never got to the rural areas. So no candles for us because our breath might carry something from those awful city people to her. She had such a way with her social inferiors, such a je ne sais quoi, as the French say. If only it had been simply funny and not so deeply poisonous. Well, the church had a very interesting caretaker who came in every day, what you used to call a sexton. We liked each other a lot. And I would sometimes fake a Cockney accent and say things like, "Morning, sexton, how have you been faring?" And he was an introspective soul who had studied more esoteric religious books than I ever will. I'll call him Warren. Besides taking care of odds and ends at the church, Warren was also the handyman on Dorsine's family plantation, where she lived with her husband, Merv. Well, actually, Merv spent a lot of time in the state capitol, where he served as a lobbyist, working the state legislators on behalf of agribusiness concerns, pushing enhanced tax breaks for landowners, but holding back on those concessions for the Haitian field hands, wearing a suit and tie, of course. But lobbying was really how the whole family got things done. A lobbyist doesn't need to worry about the truth or principles. You know the drill. You work on the climate of choice, the environment of decision making. Take the boys on a cruise ship, pass the fine cigars, serve a leg of lamb, maybe baby ewe lamb. Arrange to bring some other babes for company. Loosen those ties and tighten those no strings attached. When you control the environment of choice, the truth hardly matters. They'll just have to go along. Well, back in the tamer environment of church, Dorsine never sat by herself quietly worrying about someone or something that she didn't like. She would get others to worry with constant threats and hints about what some people were saying. She got everyone else worried about her issues by acting as if they just had to be. Eventually, folks would find themselves going along with her just to reduce the anxiety level. She worked our environment of choice probably better than her husband worked his politicians. Well, speaking of environment, one day while Warren the sexton was working to rearrange a storeroom in the church basement, he found a box of neatly bound minutes of board meetings from the middle years of the 20th century. Thumbing through the years of his childhood, like you would if you found a pile of magazines, this from years of my childhood, my life, and which these years for Warren also happened to be the years of Joe McCarthy and the communist witch hunts in our country, he found an interesting document. It was a letter from Dorsine written in the early 1950s. He read it carefully and then brought it up to my office to show me. The letter was to the board and the minister, and in it Dorsine demanded that all the communists be thrown out of church immediately. It's not clear from the records who these communists were, possibly an early social justice group concerned about the rights of the Haitian field workers who at that time lived in unheated shacks without water or electricity. Or possibly there really were bearded Bolsheviks who wore funny hats and made those round bombs in the basement. Remember those from the cartoons? I would say bomb on it in case you didn't. Anyway, who knows who they were, but they were church members, from what the letter said. Universalists, like Dorsine. And Dorsine blamed the church for having them there. If the board and the minister would not force these communists out, Dorsine threatened to lead an exodus of the wealthy families out of the church, who would take their money with them. She claimed that she had already secured their agreement and to be speaking on behalf of all these families, working the environment, you see. She would bring the church down. It would all be the church's fault for not seeing things her way. Warren and I looked through more minute books to see what the board and minister had done, but we couldn't find anything. Either nothing happened, or it happened off the record in the lobby. But Dorsine was still there, along with her rich relatives, decades later, the sun still shining through the angel on the stained glass window that bears her family name, right on her sweet face. Maybe the people Dorsine didn't like had been made so uncomfortable that they all left on their own. Or maybe neither board nor minister could think of any reason why, as Universalists with a long history of social experimentation, including some of its socialist and communistic experimentation, why they should do anything about the so-called communists in their midst, except attach Dorsine's letter to the minutes. The letter was a good example of the opposite of what Universalism was all about. Maybe they saved it as a good example for future generations of how far many Universalists still had to go in learning to practice what they claimed was their religion. I still have a long way to go myself. You know from this story that I sometimes fall short, not only in doing, but even in saying what I should as a Universalist or a Unitarian, let alone someone who's supposed to carry the flame of both traditions high and bright through day or night. I was once by the side of a motel swimming pool, trying while on vacation from Dorsine's church to explain classic Universalism to another guest. I told him that old-time Universalists didn't believe in hell or the devil. God loves forever all, they said. And no one was created just so they could be condemned to eternal punishment. And then he threw me for a loop with what should have been an easy question. So how did they say you get saved? He was a black American, the chief of a small fire department. So saving, you know, really meant something to him. How did they say you get saved? I started in on a long response about how we don't look at things that way anymore and how people are free to work out their own religious paths and so on and so forth, the kind of things we say around coffee to newcomers. And he said again, but I still don't see how you get saved. I couldn't answer in the religious terms that he was familiar with. To be honest, I just couldn't say. And then a few days later, the right words came to me. You know how that happens. The problem was that I'd gone home. I wanted to rush back to the motel, find the guy, and tell him that I just had a flash for the first time myself about what the Universalist tradition still teaches us about getting saved. You get saved by living as if everyone has got to be. I'm not saying that I understand that completely, or that I'm living that way yet, but I wish I could have told him that you get saved by living as if everyone has got to be. It was too late, so I had to save these words for someone else to overhear some other time. When you miss one opportunity, you have to wait for another and hope that it'll come. Now, Dorsine may have been the worst Unitarian Universalist that I had ever met, but I have to say this for her. She tried to push others out of the church, or else she threatened to leave while the stained glass angels cried out, "Hallelujah!" But she stayed. She stayed. She kept coming back for opportunity after opportunity to hear the message of the church she'd grown up in and that her family practically owned. She didn't leave. in spite of all the damage and bitter feelings that her threats to do so had caused for so many years. She kept coming back. She stayed, for better or worse. And for all I know, she's finally overheard the Universalist message and gotten it. You get saved by living as if everyone has got to be. The poor, the rich, the lambs, the leaders in this whole holy city where we must live together. Things like sermons, hymns, covenants of right relations, or the principles and purposes you find each week on the back of your order of service are there to help us work out the details of what we try to do right here, right now, and every day. You've got them in your hands. Please keep them in your hearts. And don't just leave them on your seats or somewhere out in the lobby. Blessed be.